Thank you very much. It's an honor and a privilege to be here because this is a field I've gotten into only recently. I spent most of my professional career involved in the criminal justice system, either as an agent or as a lawyer at the Justice Department in different capacities, but I have not focused on controlled substances. So I've gotten into this problem recently, and what caught my eye was that in this whole debate about medical marijuana, we did not see a great deal of discussion about whether there was a risk to highway safety. And I think if you look at the problem fairly, that you'll see that there are essentially three sub-problems that come up, okay? The first is that marijuana use poses an increased risk of an automobile accident. Now, why is that? Well, at bottom, I suppose the problem is it reduces your reaction time. To some extent, what happens when you use marijuana, ironically, is the opposite of what happens when you use alcohol. People drive, if you will, more passively rather than aggressively, as in the case of alcohol, and they try to compensate. They'll leave more room between themselves and somebody else, and they'll try not to pass, all that. But there's nothing you can do to compensate for a diminished reaction speed, and that is where the risk comes into play. I mean, there are other little things, too. The lateral movement seems to be worse in people who are under the influence of THC, but the real risk is the reaction speed. That's why there is an accident, but you don't have to take my word for it. The Institute for Medicine, the British Medical Association, the World Health Organization, and numerous scholars, many of whom are here at this conference, have said there is an increased risk. So if you take that as being a granted, then you have to go on to the second problem, which is if there is a risk, then we are at risk of reversing 40 to 60 years of efforts we've made to make driving safer by reducing the number of people who stay too long at happy hour and then get behind the wheel. We have made significant inroads in the morbidity and mortality resulting from the use of alcohol and then driving a vehicle. To add now marijuana into it and take the risk of increasing the morbidity and mortality would create a problem at a public policy issue because we're moving in the opposite direction. Now, the third problem that arises is, unfortunately, the model we have used for quite some time for alcohol simply will not work in this context. And so what we need to do is find an alternative way of dealing with this problem. Now, why does the alcohol model not work well in this context? Remember, there are two ways to prove that someone is driving under the influence of X, whether X is alcohol, whether it's a drug, or something else. One is to prove that the person was operating the vehicle in an unsafe manner. You could basically say they were crossing the red line, they were going at 120 miles an hour in a 60 mile per hour zone, etc. But you also, to some extent in these sort of circumstances, have to rely on the subjective judgment of the officer. And the problem historically with alcohol has always been most people have thought that there, but for the grace of God, go I. They were very willing to allow people to escape liability, even though they may have thought they were clearly guilty simply because they knew that they or others they knew and perhaps were closely related to had done the same thing in the past. So unless there was a great deal of objective evidence proving impairment, there were a large number of acquittals early on. But then when we developed the BAC standard, the 0.15 and then 0.10 and then 0.08, it progressively went down. You now had a more objective standard that people could point to. It was developed as a result of analyses and studies over a large number of cases, over a great deal of time, and eventually through some, you know, nudging by Congress, every one of the 50 states and the District of Columbia now has a 0.8 BAC standard that they can use. And that's the alternative way now of proving that someone is driving it under the influence. You can do it by showing that they are impaired by a drug and driving recklessly, or you can show 0.08, which is deemed as a matter of law, to now be impaired, even if you were not impaired in fact. And there may be people that can have a 0.08 alcohol amount in their blood because they may, ironically, be very long-term drinkers, can handle their alcohol, and they could safely drive a vehicle. But the law deems 0.08 as the standard regardless of whether you could drive with that amount or higher and win the Indy 500. Now, the unfortunate thing is THC is not alcohol. THC and the body react differently. Alcohol, for example, is very water-soluble. The result is it easily gets into the blood system. And then it easily gets into the brain by crossing the blood-brain barrier. So if you're doing blood testing, you know that you're going to be able to figure out not whether the blood is intoxicated, but whether the brain is. And what you can also do then is use what now is a device we've developed for this, which is the breathalyzer. Why? Because you will expire as you breathe out a certain amount of alcohol that they can then mathematically use as a basis for computing how much is then in your blood and then therefore how much is in your brain. The problem is, by and large, you have to throw both of those tools out when you're dealing with THC. Unfortunately, we don't know what the, well, I suppose we would call the BTC factor, the is. And we don't know because there are numerous factors that are involved in how the body processes THC, largely because it's lipophilic. What you're going to have then, unfortunately, is see THC being sequestered in the body over a long period of time, released slowly, but not into the bloodstream in a certain amount that will allow for a person to be intoxicated. The result is the science now for alcohol doesn't work for the case of THC. The second problem is, nor does the engineering. We don't have a roadside device that we can use, like a breathalyzer, that will allow a police officer on the side of the road in a non-invasive manner to detect whether or not you've got whatever the model number is of THC in your blood. So we can't do that. So even if we knew what the standard was, we don't have a way of testing for it. Now, what have states done to deal with that? The states are dying to have a number they can point to, because they have been able successfully to use the 0.08 standard. Unfortunately, we don't know one, so what they've decided to do in a large number of states is adopt a zero tolerance or per se standard. It may be zero, it may be 0.02, whatever. And if you have any amount of that THC in your blood, you're considered to be intoxicated. The problem with that is both it is scientifically and legally irrational. Now, some people say we should just wait for science to get to this problem because science and engineering will solve it for us. To some extent, that could be like waiting for Godot, long and unproductive. We don't know when there'll be a device, and we don't know when there'll be a level that the device can test. So what we need to do is figure out a way of dealing with these problems now. The zero tolerance and the per se standards are an effort to deal with it now. But as I said, the problem is they are subject to being challenged on the ground that they are scientifically and legally irrational. They're scientifically irrational because you can have measurable quantities of THC in your blood long after the psychoactive effect has worn off. For people who are heavy users, it can come out as long as a month, but in any event, it can come out days, weeks, whatever, depending on how much you've used. The result is getting any number doesn't tell you that the person was intoxicated at the time that person was driving. And it gets more complicated, of course, if you have a state with a medical marijuana law and everything else, because there you have express permission to use it, so it's not surprising you would find some quantity of THC in someone's blood. It is also legally irrational. And here, there have been a few trials made to try to challenge these laws in the states, and the states have generally rejected them. But they've looked at it, in my view, in the wrong way. They generally tend to look at this as an equal protection problem. Why are you picking on THC rather than anything else? They say there's no fundamental right to use marijuana, this is not a suspect class, et cetera, and those arguments are rejected. The problem is the Supreme Court has actually dealt with a very similar problem. It dealt with the similar problem in one case in 1969 and one in 1970. The 69 case may, at least for some of you, if you're even remotely close to my age, will find that a familiar party in it. The name of that case was Leary versus United States. And yes, it was that Dr. Timothy Leary. What happened in that case was he was convicted for possessing very small, almost trivial amounts of marijuana when he was turned away from trying to go to Mexico and then came back into Texas. He was convicted of smuggling marijuana. The problem was he obviously hadn't been in Mexico because they turned him around at the border. So the government relied on a statutory presumption. The presumption said you can presume that marijuana was necessarily imported. Well, the Supreme Court looked at it and said it doesn't make sense. There is no reason to believe that the marijuana that he had came from Mexico, certainly not in this case. There's no reason to believe that most of it comes from Mexico because so much of it is grown locally in the United States. The statute, therefore, cannot arbitrarily deem something to be proved unless you can prove it in fact. A later case came along and elaborated on that a little. It came out within 6 months of the Leary case, a case called Turner versus United States. Turner and his colleagues were charged with importing heroin and cocaine, and the Supreme Court came out very differently on each one. With respect to heroin, they said, this can be fairly conclusively proved that heroin is not grown in the United States. So the government is entitled to rely on a presumption that anyone who in the United States has heroin got it from the outside and knew that it came in from the outside. With respect to cocaine, they said it was different. A certain amount of cocaine is lawfully imported because it's used in various types of medical procedures, and therefore you can't presume that it came in from the outside. And those convictions, therefore, were set aside. Those decisions create a terrible problem for the per se laws. Why? Well, we know that scientifically, we can't use the fact that someone has any amount of THC in their blood. And now we know legally there is a limit to how much the government can presume rather than prove in an individual case. So, is there an alternative that we can use at least in the short run till perhaps science deals with this? And the answer is yes. But it comes at this problem from a different direction. And that is to lower the BAC level. Why? It is very common for people who smoke marijuana also to consume alcohol. And we know that the combination of alcohol and THC has a far greater disabling effect on individuals than either one alone. The result being this: if you are in a state that has a 0.08 standard for alcohol, and you are at 0.05, you could also be impaired if you've had enough marijuana to wind up adding the two together in such a way that now, as a factual matter, you can't be impaired. But the states don't want to have to go that route. So the alternative is, for example, in a state where there is a medical marijuana law, require the people to register. And then if a cop stops somebody, he can go to his vehicle, he runs the test, he sees if you've got a license to use medical marijuana, and if you're 0.05, now you're intoxicated as a matter of law, because it's reasonable to presume that people who have the license are going to be using the drug for which they applied to use. Okay? Alternatively, the state could just decide, we're just going to lower it across the board and treat every one of our citizens the same. That's reasonable, too, because believe it or not, at a 0.05 level, there is a marked impairment in the amount of alcohol that's now caused your ability to drive to go down. Many European countries use a 0.05 standard. We use a 0.0 standard for commercial drivers. We use a 0.0 standard for minors, people under the age of 21 who were driving. So it's not an arbitrary number just to pick out. And we know that you can test for it. So now we get to the three questions. Is it scientifically reasonable? Yes. Because you're now going to know, even if you didn't have anybody in the state go one toke over the line, a 0.05 standard would save lives. Legally permissible? You bet. Why? Because you're trying to save lives, you've got an entirely legitimate reason for what you're doing, and you're relying on good quality evidence. Is it politically doable? Here's the problem. The alcohol community will hate you like there's no tomorrow. Why? Bars, liquor stores, Budweiser, you name it, they'll hate it. But if what you're trying to do is save lives by keeping people from going to happy hour and then toking up before they get to the car, it's better to have Budweiser and all these other people trying to claim it's okay to have them drink than it is to try to challenge what's going on here. At least you are now in the world where it's debatable. You don't have to worry about science running afoul of whatever you're trying to do. You may lose, but you at least have the opportunity to engage in a political debate over a reasonable way to save lives. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Interesting idea. Depending on how things play out in Vermont, we might be actually be able to test this. Last but not least, we have Candace Langer, who's going to provide us a national overview for thinking about driving under the influence.
So which button do I push here?
The red one?
3 o'clock.
Yes, this one is
forward.
The red one is forward.
Okay, sorry. This one's forward?
Yes. Arrow forward. Backwards.
I'm sorry. This is forward?
Yeah.
How do you do this?
Don't you just love working with me?
James, I'm not going to be able to do this.
It should be one button.
I can't see that, and
it's my age.
You can just point at me.
Okay, thank you.
Just advance the slide.
I go everywhere with him. He's like 27. I'm going to be 70 next month. What can I say? So let me give you a little background on me, because he introduced me as the founder of MAD, which I am. I'm not here on behalf of MAD. MAD doesn't do anything on drug driving. I'm here on behalf of We Save Lives, which is an organization I founded several years ago. We focus on the three Ds, drunk, drugged, and distracted driving. And I take pride in saying we are the first advocate, activist organization who actually lobbied, advocated on the issue of drugged driving on a national perspective. And we've been doing it for several years. So I also want to give you another little story about me, which most people don't know unless you read the book Soul Models. My foray into the drug world happened when I was about 19 years old. I was living in Germany. My girlfriend was living in California, in San Francisco, kept talking about this wonderful resort. And you have to understand, this is back in the 60s. I thought, this sounds great. I'll come join her. I did, got off the plane in Germany, was picked up by a guy in a long black robe and sideburns and a beard. I thought he was a rabbi. So we get to this beach resort. The big brother of the community came bounding up. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and he said, oh, welcome. And by the way, I'm so stoned. And I turned to my girlfriend, Susie, and I said, what's he doing drunk at 2 o'clock in the afternoon? She looked at me strangely. Now understand, I've been living in Europe and in a military family. And she took me over to a picnic bench overlooking the ocean, and she said, do you smoke grass? And I said, well, how do you get it up off the ground? And she said, oh no, marijuana. And I said, what's that? And she said, do you drop acid? I said, doesn't it burn going down your throat? This commune, as it turned out to be, frequented by Janis Joplin, whom I knew, the Big Brother, Quicksilver Messengers, etc., ended up giving me my own room. I was the only one, because they were so afraid that if I saw them smoking, drugging, in my innocence and naivete, I might say something to other people. So I was the only one in the commune that had my own room. I could tell you how to go about doing it, but I wouldn't do that again. I went on to become a drug counselor for heroin and other drug-addicted GIs during the Vietnam War when we were stationed in Okinawa, Japan. I'm also the parent of a drug-addicted son, and I am the grandparent of drug-addicted grandchildren. So I want to talk a little bit about the anti-drunk driving movement, which I started, and do a little comparison between it and the anti-drug driving movement. You'll hear me use the term DUID because it's easier to understand. And most of you know I had a daughter who was killed by a drunk driver many years ago, multiple repeat offender. Nobody was doing anything about drunk driving. I became the face of the victim, as did hundreds of other mothers and fathers who followed me. We had what we call boots on the ground now, formed chapters in every single state. We were able to lobby very successfully. During my tenure at MAD, we passed more than 2,000 laws that dealt with the drunk driving problem. We reduced death and injuries caused by drunk drivers by more than 20%. Also during my tenure, the drunk driving age was raised to 21 across the border, and we did this because of blood borders, which is one of the concerns, by the way, I have about the legalization issue of marijuana. We do not take a position, by the way, on legalization or the medicinal use. We take a position on drug driving. And so when we saw blood borders, kids crossing over, killing themselves, etc., we decided we needed to do 21 across the board. We led the charge, as you know. It was a history-making bill, one of the fastest bills that ever passed out of Congress. And again, it's because we had so many people involved in this. And I stand by our record, even though there are colleges that disagree with me. We have reduced death and injuries in that particular age group by quite a number. So at the same time we were doing this, President Reagan was in office. His wife, Mrs. Reagan, was very big on the drug issue, and she started the Just Say No movement, which a lot of people really think has not worked. I can't tell you that one way or another. But one of the things that we have found is the pro-marijuana movement is very well financed, unlike the anti-marijuana movement or even the drugged driving movement. They're very well financed, they're very well organized, and they're very good at promoting their theme. The thing that concerns me the most in terms of their promotion, and I've heard it, seen it, and dealt with it, is that it's really okay to drive drugged, believe me, I've seen it, and it's not a serious problem, and it's not like alcohol. I'm really sick of the comparison, because they're both serious when it comes to driving behavior. So just saying it's not as bad as alcohol doesn't mean it's not bad. It is. And they often do cite studies with no support. I can't find links that go to the studies, who did it, who said it, etc., as I see them in quotes. So I have a concern about that. Now, one of the things that we do is we have, we'll put studies on our Facebook page, for example, some of the recent studies that have come out on marijuana. And you cannot believe the response. It's absolutely unbelievable. I mean, I wish I could wear glasses strong enough to see some of these things, but I mean, seriously. Dude, where'd you get your information from? Spelling is atrocious, and I drive better, etc., etc. And it goes on from there. 99.9% of our responses whenever we do anything, on marijuana, is, where are you getting your information? Not true. I drive better. It's safer. Can't be unsafe, etc. We actually are the only organization that did an anti-drug driving PSA or video, which you should see on our website. Young and Rubicon, a major advertising agency, adopted us. And they did this called the Weed Advisor. And they went to the Hemp Festival in Colorado, developed these papers with two little cars coming together, as you roll the weed. And then at the end they crash, and there's a very concern. So I said to them, there's no way any store in Colorado is going to show, just for, it's not going to happen. You can't believe the stores that wanted these papers and did use them. And the response was, go on our website and go to this video, because it's phenomenal. These are not actors, these are real people who were doing this and saying, wow, you know, I haven't really thought about that. But when we posted it, these are our, you know, this is probably sponsored by the alcohol companies. The vast majority know this is a scare tactic. Yeah, go drink, it's much safer. But I thought pot makes you drive better. Ever find anyone dead from pot? Right? No one. Those of us who need it for pain are being denied. I love this one. IDK about you guys, but I am much more alert when I dive under the influence. Doesn't that make you feel good when you go out on the road? I mean, this is what we get. Now, for those of you who haven't seen the video, and almost 1 million people have, we have one now called Reflections from Inside, which is actually a prisoner, a man who killed a police officer drunk driving, sentenced to 15 years. These guys are in a bar. They go in, this has happened in a bar, and they go in to wash their hands, and when they do and look in the mirror goes up, Chris Cadella, the prisoner, actually starts speaking to them about what he did. It's incredibly powerful, very emotional, very impactful. The comments, which I can't read, are 100% different. Wow, I used to drink and drive. I'm not now. Wow, I can't believe this. It's wrong. It's bad. We shouldn't do it. Not one comment has defended the right to drink and drive. Unlike the comments we get from marijuana, which do defend their right to drive drugged. The problem we have now, the problem we have now is it took MAD to make drunk driving socially unacceptable. We don't have that same kind of movement today to make drugged driving socially unacceptable. So right now it's very socially acceptable, and I got this off of some of the websites here that promote cannabis. It's medically necessary, makes you drive better, become more inventive, artistic, and innovative, helps you blossom into a talkative, outgoing person, brings a temporary giddiness that allows you to escape from your normal day-to-day happenings and energizes your senses. I wouldn't mind this so much if they just then put on a warning, by the way, don't get in the car. You know, if you want to take drugs, stay home. Don't drive, that's all. So
So what's wrong with the movement today?
Well, actually, there isn't one. To be honest with you, there really isn't. It's not a problem. I hear all this data about numbers, and I'm so suspicious because we don't test. We don't know. We really don't know because we really don't test. There's a lack of data, stats, and reliable numbers. Law enforcement doesn't test. It's an ongoing issue. I deal with them all the time. There's a lack of education, a lack of prosecution, which is one of the reasons why the Per Se movement happened, because prosecutors don't want to prosecute and lose. And so they feel by having Per Se, they can win. There's a lack of PSAs. Can you go back?
Yep, sorry.
Thank you. A lack of media interest. Sorry, they all smoke. I had that same problem with drunk driving. They all drank and they all drove. Lack of government support, believe me. There are very few boots on the ground, and there is no public face for the statistics, as there was with drunk driving. So as a result, they frequently escape prosecution, which means no convictions, which means no punishment or accountability, which means no rehabilitation, which means no justice for the victim, survivor, and no protection for society. So this is just, we partner, by the way, with Stop DYD. We're a partner organization. We partner with about 50 groups around the world. And we partner with Stop DYD, and they do keep very good track if you ever want to know what's going on with drug driving in terms of what laws are pending, what laws have passed, et cetera. You can just go right to their website. And this is, you know, kind of model states of who's
specific
doing
to
what.
Pardon? The other one is all drugs. This is specific to marijuana.
Thank you. Okay. So solutions. What are some of the solutions? We believe you need to separate the statutes. That's one way of getting data. You have one for drunk driving, one for drug driving. Some states do it, many do not. We happen to support the use of oral fluid devices, which is your roadside test device. They do have them for drugs. They're actually coming out with a marijuana breathalyzer. I hear from these people all the time, so believe me, there's a bunch more coming out. Oral fluid devices have been used very successfully in Europe, especially in Great Britain, and they're now being used in this country. We actually have several bills in certain states that will allow these to be used. They can be done at roadside. We believe that there should be mandatory testing for all when there's probable cause, because again, we don't test, we don't know. We obviously support additional training for DREs and reduce the delays in collecting blood samples, which is another reason why we really don't know how serious the problem is, because it takes so long to get a blood sample. By the time you do, it's useless.
I think we're out of time, Candace.
Okay.
So you know they're motioning.
Okay, just go to the last.
Oh, yes.
So you can find out how we're doing it, and I just want to go to
a little more than 15 minutes left for Q&A, so if anyone in the audience, I think they're going to come around and have a microphone.
To take cannabis, the high CBD product, but unfortunately everyone talks about it as if it's one product. You know, you don't know what's being tested, what isn't being tested. He can't do the sports and partake in a medical cure because it's so grouped as one product. And I like that, you know, you want to separate medical marijuana and what are the driving restrictions from the alcohol restrictions. I agree with that movement, but how do we then define it even better to support, you know, things like athletes?
What we want to do is separate the charges.
Use the mic, please. Yeah, thanks.
What we want to do is separate the charges of drugged driving, not just marijuana impaired driving, but drugged driving from drunk driving. So I can't answer your question in terms of what to do about the sports situation or medical marijuana. It's really out of my realm, but I'm sure other people up here can.
I mean, I would only add that CBD is a separate cannabinoid. So, you know, typically, I mean, you could do testing focusing more on THC. I mean,
but any THC, according to the NCAA, is unallowable, even if it's, you know, our product is, you know, 20-1.
Yeah,
it's minuscule. Yeah. And then, but somebody who takes it, the cannabis, the residual is always the problem in the testing. But even in the CBD product, it's not going to have the same efficacy without any THC. And yet, for this young athlete, the medicine that he is on, which is a pharmaceutical product, is allowed by the NCAA, but it reduces his reaction time. So he can chance having an epilepsy seizure and no medicine, or medicine that definitely makes him less athletic. And these are the level of
this
what
is tough.
We need.
Yeah, we need help with.
I'm just wondering if there are any studies looking at the effects of tolerance. So if the effects are attenuated over time with increased tolerance, or how that impacts crash risk.
Sure. I think that's one of the biggest problems. Not that there haven't been studies. There have been studies, and in fact, people know that over time, if you use it, you develop a tolerance to it. The problem that creates for driving is that it's one of the reasons why it's difficult to pick any specific number as establishing the equivalent of a BAC. Someone who is a new user, uses it a few times, uses it occasionally, very long periods in between use, is not going to develop a tolerance to it. If you're just starting, you obviously don't have a tolerance. You know, if you've been following the Grateful Dead around for a long time, you're probably in a different category. So the result is the latter group of people are going to be able to handle marijuana in a way differently than the people who are just starting out, yet they may always have a number, an amount of it in their system. And that's why you can't use a strict comparison to the BAC laws, because you're always going to get a positive test when it may have no effect. Generally, not only on that person, but certainly not on the majority of people. And if you're making it a crime to engage in a conduct that affects only a small minority, you've gone about this in the public policy approach from the wrong perspective.
Our question is for Candace. I'm a legislator from Canada, and we need data to understand the impact of policy development. So we have a 0.05 law that has actually saved a lot of lives, and it's administrative penalties, which is politically easier than criminal penalties. But if what we hear from Uli and others is that the impact of marijuana is not nearly the impact of, say, alcohol, how do we take that data and say, okay, well, what about texting and driving? Are we putting enough effort into other things that will save lives, which is obviously what you want to do? So do you feel like efforts on drug driving would be better spent on things like texting and driving, for instance, or other things that we know cause crashes?
No. And the reason is we don't test enough to really know how serious the problem is. So when I hear things like, some of the stuff that came up here, and I can't remember what it is, so much of it, it's too much for me. We don't really know. I can tell you that working with law enforcement and working with some of our partners who do rehabilitation, they will tell me that the people that come in there tell them they were doing drugs at the same time they were driving under the influence of alcohol. They were never tested for drugs, so their rehabilitation centers on alcohol. But they'll say, oh, I was on drugs too. So law enforcement tells me that when they go out and arrest, they're actually seeing an increase in drugged driving and a decrease in drunk driving. But again, we're not testing. So my belief is we need more data by testing. We need to do the things that we mentioned to get the data, because we happen to believe it's a far more serious problem than most people recognize and acknowledge. But as you know, we support the three Ds, including distracted driving, too. So.
I would only add about the testing is that there's incredible variation across the states. In the data set that I use, the FARS, it ranged across this time period from almost 80% in Montana to 3% in Maine. So there's incredible state differences, not only in testing rates, but in how they test and so forth. So there's a great need for better data in that regard to answer some of these policy questions. And a lot of what we're doing, and certainly my research, is trying to attempt a very difficult to answer a very difficult question with data that has a lot of reliability issues associated with it.
Let me just say one thing. There are numerous activities that people could engage in that reduce their ability to respond in a manner necessary to avoid an accident. It's not just consuming alcohol or THC, not getting enough sleep, talking to the people in the car, playing with your cell phone or texting, playing with the radio. The problem is there's only so many things that you can do to try to encourage people to be safe when they're behind the wheel of a 2,000-pound bullet. And the more things you try to take on, the less likelihood it is that any one of them will probably succeed for you.
So given the lack of kind of federal cooperation and coordination on this issue, which you had with DUI and with alcohol, do you think it's even possible to get a sufficient amount of states kind of moving forward together in lockstep on this? And if it is, like, how do you guys think from a policy perspective you can tackle some kind of coordinated effort to address this at the state level?
The coordination is not the problem. Every state gets federal highway funds. What Congress did when it raised the driving age and the drinking age was to say, if you don't do what we're telling you to do, you lose some of your federal highway funds. Now, a state could decide that, no, we're not going to have 21 as the drinking age. We're going to keep it at 18. And there are, an argument for that. But then they're going to lose a certain amount of state highway funds, and state legislators don't generally want to do that, because if they want to make up for that, then they have to raise taxes, and they don't want to do that. So it's the problem is not that there isn't a mechanism by which Congress can get the states to move in the same direction. The problem is Congress is no better than the state legislatures are in knowing what the right number is, or in having a device that can measure what number a person has.
Well, and there's no groundswell of movement for Congress to do that.
I think that what's kind of been ignored here is there's some fundamental differences in how when you drink, the reason that the breathalyzer works is that 5% of what you drink comes out through your lungs, and it's very accurate. For THC and for cannabinoids, the science isn't there. And until we can kind of figure that problem out, I mean, you can tell if someone's been exposed to THC. You can't tell when. You can't tell, in some cases, whether it's secondhand exposure. There's been some studies from Ryan Vantry's lab that have shown that secondhand exposure, you can still get THC levels. And so I think until you can kind of address those scientific issues, it's going to be very hard to say, well, we just need to test, because the levels are not necessarily associated with how intoxicated someone is. You can say the same thing with alcohol. However, I think there are some pharmacokinetic reasons that THC might be different, because you do get pharmacokinetic tolerance, whereas with alcohol, you don't so much. It's more pharmacodynamic and behavioral. So I think until we address some of those fundamental science questions, it's going to be difficult to address some of the policy issues.
I would just like to add something that has surprised me a bit. I think there's one question is like how you do this in the regulatory setting. But the second thing, which I think you mentioned, was the social tolerance of driving while influenced. And you know, it might be because I'm from Europe, but when I see American movies, if you see movies that have to do with people smoking pot, whether it's Seth Rogen or Harold and Kumar, you know, getting in a car and driving is just presented as something you can do. It's seen as something that's like no biggie, and there's never any negative consequences associated with it. If anything, it's presented as fun. And I think that's, like, dealing with that issue is something that you could proceed on, even if the science is not there on all the issues that, you know, that you, we need to do it in a regulatory setting. But really trying to do something about that social acceptance seems to me like a very valuable thing. And I thought, that, you know, even that rolling paper, that was really cool.
Go to besavewise.org, our Facebook, our website, you'll see the PM.
Yeah, but also I think some of the problem here might be, I think some of the comments that you get where people sort of say, oh, this is just propaganda, it's probably a legacy problem from the fact that there has been a lot of propaganda that has been very exaggerated around the topic of marijuana use. And having sort of, let's say, sober claims about how big the problem is, and but that it is a real issue, is something that maybe would tone that down. I don't know.
I just want to follow on that point and say, from the research that I presented today, you know, where you have states with dispensaries showing higher rates of, you know, accepting the fact that we have all these issues with testing and so forth, in states that pass laws allowing dispensaries for medical marijuana, there might be a policy need to attach, you know, at the state level some sort of education or maybe more rolling papers, I don't know, but additional policy approaches to reduce getting behind the wheel after certainly while stoned.
And ideally, you'd want to have those campaigns set up in place before the stores open. Mm-hmm. That's one of the issues. Oftentimes, people will legalize the heck out of it. We'll get all this tax revenue. Yeah, well, money comes in, but it's not usually as much as we predicted. But then also, it's going to take a while to develop all that messaging. So especially in places like California, where it could actually be happening soon, it seems like you want to start now in developing these campaigns, especially for those who are driving under the influence of both alcohol and cannabis. And Candace, you get the final.
Thank you.
The final thought.
We're actually out of time. This really has nothing to do with marijuana, but I feel very passionate about it, and I've heard the term used all day today. This is not an accident. Impaired driving is a crime, and we need to quit calling it an accident. We don't call murder an accident. We don't call rape an accident, but impaired driving is a crime. It's a criminal act. And when you say the word accident, it's like no one's at fault, and that's not correct. So if I ruled the world and could make 15 changes, this would be one of my changes. We actually have been launching this campaign for some time. We actually got an AP-style book now to change their definition of the word accident for reporters. Won't come out until June because of this. So when you're doing your research, when you're putting your PowerPoints up, etc., please stop and think about the choice of words. There's nothing accidental about distracted driving, drunk driving, or drugged driving. Thank you.
So call it A.
Huh?
So call it A.
Well, we call it a crash initially until we know what's happening, and then we call it a crime.
Yeah, I'm just saying crashes,
right.
So they can find it.
Right. Oh, yeah, it's drop the A word. It's our drop the A word.
Great. Let's thank our panel. This is a great show.